We will begin with our first panel, is there room for big agriculture in a small setting? So, starting us off today is Dr. Lenora Newman. Lenora is the Canada Research Chair for Food Security and the Environment at the University of the Fraser Valley. She started her academic career at the University of British Columbia and earned an honors BSc in Physics and Astronomy. During a period of extensive travel, Lenora developed a strong interest in food and the environment, prompting her to pursue her master's and PhD in environmental studies at York University. Her thesis developed a complex adaptive systems theory approach to sustainable development. And at Royal Roads University on Vancouver Island, Lenora did postdoctoral work studying community-level sustainable development, urban form, and the geography of farmers' markets. She continued this work as an assistant professor in the School of Environment and Sustainability at Royal Roads University. And in her spare time, Lenora is a freelance writer. We like those. And enjoys hiking, culinary anthropology, and eating interesting foods. I think I want to hear more. She lives in East Vancouver and spends a lot of time haunting farmers markets, coffee shops, and obscure library collections. This sounds like a woman after our own hearts, Dr. Lenora Newman.
All right, thank you kindly. And it's great to be here. And that's kind of a strange experience, hearing one's own bio like that. It makes me sound actually quite pulled together. And it actually goes back a little further. I was born into a fishing family. My family are Santula Finns. For the BCers in the room, that means something. And as soon as I was old enough to walk, my dad put me to work selling fish on the dock. My sister and I, our earliest memories are hauling halibut around. And so whenever I see farm kids out like lifting hay and doing things that you're like, wow, that's a small kid out working, actually doing something, I'm like, yeah, I know that life. And so today, I'm going to talk a bit about this idea of agriburbia. And what I'm doing is I'm giving kind of a big overview, and Kim is going to really come in with a lot of detail, and I think this is really going to work well together. And just before I start, this is actually a Canadian lemon growing outside on the Saanich Peninsula, and so for those of you from back east, this truly is a land of wonders. And no, we can't do that here, but on Vancouver Island, indeed. I want to open today by reminding everyone that history tends to repeat itself. And great cities have always fed themselves from outside their walls, from the margins, and draw in resources from the surrounding countryside. This isn't exactly rocket science, but it is first thing in the morning, so we're going to build up. And I'm here today to make a prediction that gets me laughed out of a lot of rooms, but I'll try it again. One of the strong future branches of agriculture is going to be suburban. So be ready to write about that. And that might seem counterintuitive, because we tend to think of farming often as an activity that happens out there, wherever out there is. And believe me, urban Canadians out there, oh my goodness, it's a, here in Vancouver, as soon as you cross the Portman Bridge, zombies attack your car, tumbleweeds roll by. I mean, they're really, the urban world, it's a long way away from here today. But we also, in the urban media, hear more and more about this idea of urban farming. And we hear that this is the age of the urban. Well, first off, urban farming has a hard time producing great quantities of food, and we do eat great quantities of food, so we need it somewhere. And if you actually look at the numbers, and I'm a geographer by trade these days, Canada is a suburban nation, not an urban nation. And it's a suburban world, or to use a technical term, peri-urban, which is what geographers actually call it. The areas around our major world centers have a life of their own, and they're growing increasingly complicated. And to put it in perspective, 70% of Canadians live in suburban areas. And so if you meet a Canadian, they may say they're from Toronto, Vancouver, whatever, but really they're from the Lower Mainland probably, or they're from the Golden Horseshoe, or they're from the Trans-de-Banlieue around Montreal. And that's where the action is. And in this region, you get to see the future of farming, is what I like to say. And I won't skip ahead, but we'll get there. I get the next slide. Thank you. All right, and this is LA. Just sort of take it in for a minute. I'm going to give you a really quick geography lesson. This is what we call a regional city. A man named Ed Soja invented the term. He's at UCLA. And the little geography lesson goes like this. In the 20th century, geographers followed what is called the Chicago School of Urbanism. We saw cities as there'd be a downtown full of businessmen, and I stress men, and then there'd be an inner ring of suburb, outer ring of suburb, some factories, and somewhere way out of that bullseye would be farmland waiting to be turned into more city. Farmland was just a passive thing, and it was passe. No one worried about it, and zoning was really separate, and the city just kept pouring outward. And this is also, and this does come in, just gotta pay it, you sort of have, the payoff comes a little later on this part. It's also the era of what we call the Populux in food. Those of you who remember the 50s, 60s, 70s might remember Jell-O, lots of Jell-O. A lot of processed food. Let's just say that during that period, cooking was out, chemistry was in, and we saw farmland fall to suburbs all over the continent in incredible amounts. Except, late in the 20th century, a bunch of urban planners, as I mentioned at UCLA, said, wait, LA doesn't look like that. It looks totally different. And what happens here is Los Angeles is a city with many centers. You've got Long Beach, you've got Santa Monica, you've got the actual downtown, which is it's here somewhere, it's probably behind me. Oh yeah, there it is, up there. You have Pasadena. And what you have is what we call a conurbation. This is one big city. There are 17 million people in this basin eating every day. And you will notice it's very gray. What's missing is farmland. It's one big, huge sprawl. And the LA school said, this is what the cities of the future look like. And you take a city like Tokyo, there's 100 million people in Tokyo. Think of that, 100 million people eating three meals a day. And that gets kind of intense. Now, the other thing that people really hate when I say, but they kind of see my point, Vancouver is an LA school city. Vancouver is this same model. Four of the five biggest cities in British Columbia are in the Fraser River Delta, and it's all one big city. Everyone commutes from point to point, and it's all starting to sprawl together. Except when we get to the map, it's a lot greener, and I'm getting ahead of myself slightly. Vancouver, though, is also the rise of what we call West Coast cuisine. Fresh food, local food, no Velveeta, no Jell-O. People really care about food. And so what I'm talking about a bit is where do they get it? So my point today is this area around Vancouver is full of farmland, and a very specific type of farmland. And what you get is a landscape we call agriburbia. Farmland embedded in a city region, and it's not going to look like Iowa. We have no 1,000-hectare farms here. We have small farms, intense farms, valuable farms. And this is the most important part of the talk, perhaps. I'm going to highlight three types of agriculture going on, and I know you actually saw some of it on the tours, so hopefully this will resonate. Go to the next slide. So, this idea of agriburbia. Suburban landscapes in which agriculture plays an active part. This is actually Cleveland, for those of you who are city buffs. And it's just in there because it's got a good shot of the skyscrapers in the back. And go ahead for the next one. So first of all, we have high-intensity, high-technology farms. These are farms that produce a high-quality product using as little land as possible. And I have a few examples. Here's some peppers growing in our valley. Some of you may actually recognize this particular pepper organization. The lighting here is very odd because it's augmented light. It's augmented CO2. You'll notice there's no soil. It's hydroponic. Producing really high-quality product, but big investment. At the next one. Here we have eggs rolling along. In another room here, there's 30,000 chickens. And Vancouver's a big city. It eats a lot of eggs. Where do they come from? They come from that suburban fringe. And all day, every day, these eggs just keep rolling by. Actually, when I was in there, got quite, kind of hypnotized. I was like, holy crap, it's just eggs going and going. Most people don't even know that it's there. This is an interesting shot because it's taken in the dark. That's endive. And endive is an interesting crop because you have to grow it outside, then cut it down, take the roots inside, and sprout them in a completely dark cavern. And so this is actually between Chilliwack and Abbotsford, and they're growing endive. It's the kind of crop you need a big city for, because they ship endive all over BC, but Vancouver absorbs really a lot of it because it's full of foodies. Then we have a second type of agriculture, high-value agriculture that goes well with agritourism. And what one finds there is delicate, high-value crops that you need fresh in the city. Vancouver's a gastronomic capital, so you have berries. You have really a lot of berries. They go all over the world. And you also get things like wine, things like cut flowers, fresh herbs. For example, we have people growing shiso, which is a Japanese herb that's used in Vancouver Japanese restaurants because our sushi is really famous. You get things like a field of bok choy, that kind of thing. Tends to be small, intense, high value. And the reason for this is because land is very expensive. So you have to meet that lucrative element. And what do we have? Okay, so here we have some berries. And you can see the house in the background. Over there, you can just vaguely see some greenhouses. So small compared to Saskatchewan, but not urban small. Talking 100 acres, 50 acres, 20 acres under glass. That kind of agriculture. And if I could have the next one, hopefully it's a... And this. This is actually a mead demonstration room. And you get this tourism. And this is the first point I want to say, that this is a conflicted landscape. As soon as you have agritourism, you have people coming into an industrial landscape. And as soon as that happens, complaints start. And they have this in the Napa Valley. They have it here. And so this isn't a conflict-free environment. Agriburbia comes with some problems. And if I could get the next slide. This is one of the problems. This is what city people think of when they think of farming. And just a trivia of the day, because I always love to do a little bit of trivia. It's actually a father and a daughter in the painting. It's not a husband and a wife. So next time someone asks you that for trivia, you know. I call this the rural imaginative. City people kind of expect to see square hay bales and a guy in overalls with a fiddle. When they go to their farmer's market or go out into farm country, they don't expect to see like aerial spraying or a giant building full of peppers. And so part of what you guys need to be doing is we need a bit of a, hey, this is what farming actually is, writing that is penetrating the cities. Because people are still stuck back with old MacDonald, or these two, and it causes all sorts of tension because then they move near a farm and it is so nothing like this. And I swear sometimes they expect these two to come and pose in front of the farm so they can show their friends from out of town. And so that is a problem. Now, raises the issue of the last type of farming I want to briefly touch on, if I could have another slide. Here we have some heirloom tomatoes. This is on Main Island. And that's the last type of farming we find in agriburbia, especially close to the city, is very small lot. It is biodynamic, organic, produced for farmers markets. It's young people with other jobs moving out onto some acreages and making go of it. And some of the people in my region of Abbotsford, they get a little uptight about this sometimes, but it does in some way have some benefit in that these people are great ambassadors for farming, although sometimes some of the stuff, there's again tension. Often tension between these folks and the large producers. But they're all here on this same landscape. And so I want to go back to Agriburbia a little bit. You may have noticed that LA was mostly gray. That LA basin was one of the greatest farming regions in North America before we built 17 million people worth of city on it. It was a citrus area. And it's where the term comes from. Because people advertised towns in that LA basin as places where people could move from back east and grow 10 or 20 acres of oranges and sell them into a collective aggregation service and make a little extra money and have a really nice life and then take the streetcar into LA, which had streetcars at the time. And it was this interesting landscape. Now, it went away. And the reason it went away was there was no law to protect that farmland, and so the suburbs just washed over it. Could I have the next slide? Here's Vancouver. This is a smaller region than the LA basin. And I want you guys to all take a good look at the fearful state of our agriculture here, because this is a city of now about 2 million people, and it sprawls. And to that way is ocean, can't build there. These people really hate it if we try and take their land and build on it, so can't build down there. This part is all pointy, so can't build there. Or here, although people try. And so Vancouver has to live in this basin. And before, if there's a real estate developer here, and you're about to say impossible, it has to sprawl, Singapore is a city that does not sprawl because it can't. It's totally contained, it just develops within its own footprint. What we have to do here is police that and make sure it doesn't come here, which is one of the most fertile places on Earth. The only basin that produces food more efficiently is the Nile. So Canada can pat itself on the back for that. And how we do that, and I'll just briefly touch on this because I'll start leading into Kim's, is we have an agricultural land reserve here because we were losing 6,000 hectares a year before 1974. And what we did, government put in a rule that protects farmland. And I just finished a large project with a postdoc to actually see how effective the first 40 years have been. And the answer is very effective, which is interesting. We have actually only lost in the last 40 years about 3% for most of these regions. There's a few bad ones. Weirdly enough, Langley is, they've lost quite a bit more land, but other places are quite good. Abbotsford, very good the last 40 years. One of the surprises, Surrey. Surrey is very good because they only take land out of the reserve if twice as much goes in. The problem is it's all little tiny bits, and I'm pretty sure that you're going to hear about the little tiny bit problem, because That is a problem with, and even if you preserve the land, if it gets small enough, it's really hard to farm it effectively and financially viable way. And so, I have another slide. What have I got here? Oh yeah, I closed with some chickens. I really like chickens. I have chickens as sort of semi-pets that my father occasionally killed and ate when I was a kid. And yeah, it was, you know, yeah, farm upbringing, it's, you know, life, death, all of that. This is, and I actually think I'm probably, how's my time?
You're good.
I'm good? Okay. So I want to wrap up a bit, talk about one thing. So the land reserve has preserved this land, but it has a lot of edges. And all these edges come in contact with people and housing developments and industry. And you get interesting geography there and a lot of tension. You get things like blueberry cannons that everyone complains about, even the other farmers. You get complaints over smell, over noise. When I first took the job, one of the counselors in Abbotsford said, "Now, is there anything you can do about the smell of the town?" And I thought it was kind of nice. It smells like cow. I mean, let's be honest, it smells like cow. But it's kind of pleasant. It's like Holland. Holland smells like cow. But yeah, that was their worry, is like, could we hide that cow smell somehow? And I mean, you're talking about an area where agriculture is the biggest employer and the biggest industry. So they probably should just be okay with the cow. But you get a lot of tension because the way the land reserve works, it has a lot of fragmented boundaries, has a lot of places where housing pushes into farmland, and every time that happens, people move into those places thinking that it's going to be Old MacDonald growing wine and perhaps leaving a bottle at their doorstep every now and then. And then, you know, some four-story high combine thing drives by and totally coats their house in manure, and all hell breaks loose. So the trick you find in these areas is often policing. It is trying to deal with it. Another one is in Abbotsford. We put a neat little sign saying which crop was which, and people immediately started stealing things. Apparently, all they needed was some identification. Should have put up signs that said, "This is not food." And yeah, literally, people pulling trucks over and like just harvesting. And so it's an interesting landscape because of this. All these millions of people rubbing against the edges. And I close with an interesting piece of land. This is the Eco Village, which is a bit contentious because it's an odd use. It's a group of about 50 people living on 25 acres, and they built all their housing on 5 acres that's in downtown Yarrow, which is a small original interurban stop. And they built all the housing on that, and the back is 20 acres of ALR. And it's actually an accident. The ALR is never supposed to cut a lot, but it did in this case. So what they've done is they've built a whole bunch of housing on the front and also some retail. There's a deli and there's plans for coffee shops and stuff. And then there's small lot farmers on the back. And we're talking very small. They go to farmers markets. They have a box scheme that they run in the town. But very low production. And so one of the complaints is, well, this isn't, you know, highest and best use. We could use that 20 acres to grow blueberries for export or something. But what I like about this is right on the edge, we have a policy of having an armored edge, which is probably a good idea. Like the edge has a ditch or a wall or a fence or something to keep people from crossing. But if it's all like that, you get this out of sight, out of mind thing going. And what I like about the Eco Village is occasionally having something like this, the public actually gets to see the face of farming, and then in behind this, you have actual farming. And these 50 people are voracious supporters of the land reserve, and they're great ambassadors, and they go into the city, and they sell homemade kimchi, and people are like, "Where are you from?" And they're like, "Oh, we're from this eco village. You should come out and see it sometime." So one of the interplays on this edge is, you know, always trying to find ways to invite people in without having them tromping all over. And that's part of my work. So looking forward, we've actually started a Center for Agribourbon Studies at UFV, University of Fraser Valley. University of the Fraser Valley, small though we may be, is one of only about 3 universities in North America that's located in this kind of region. And so we're one of the only ones studying it. We are going to be doing studies, looking at how this land is developing and how to fight for it, because there's a lot of sign that as Vancouver continues to grow, this tension is going to get a lot stronger. And we want to be able to get that 3% loss over 40 years down to 0% over 40 years. And I'm an academic, so I'm allowed to say that. If it was up to me, I would close the land reserve to exclusions tomorrow. Yeah, I can see people getting local people are getting nervous now. So, you get to this point where even at 3%, it's slowly eroding, and we're going to need this land. Because if you know BC, Vancouver's whole foodie scene depends on this region. You cannot get these products otherwise. There's nowhere else for them to come from because most of the rest of the province is mountains. And so if we let this farmland go, foodies in Vancouver are going to wake up one morning and be like, holy crap, why is the food all stale all of a sudden? And where did my fresh shiso and sprouts go and all those wonderful berries and peppers? So there's high stakes here. And I'll just close by saying that this work is funded by the SHRC, the Social Science and Humanities. That's early in the morning. Thank you, Research Council of Canada. And they've been very generous to us to let us explore this new landscape, and we are very appreciative, and we're very excited to be going forward with this project. And now, this is actually a beautiful segue. I will lead into, Kim is going to give a lot more detail onto this broad overview.
Thank you very much, Bernard. Right. If you go take the place of honor at the head table. Okay, our next speaker is Kim Sutherland. And for those of you who know, I've been coming to these conferences for a long time, and this font is really small, and I think I might be getting older. Okay, Kim Sutherland has worked as a regional agrologist in the BC Ministry of Agriculture for the past 12 years. Kim has a long-standing interest in intensive agricultural production systems and a real passion for the agriculture production in the Fraser Valley. Her current work is focused on ensuring that our local agriculture is environmentally sustainable and in strengthening farming as a land use. She has a keen interest in the impact of climate change on food security and the challenge of maintaining and increasing the food production capacity of first-class agriculture production zones on the urban edge. There we are.
I think I'm just
sitting
down. I'm a smart person.
Excellent. And so, to bring you all of her smartness, Kim Sutherland.
My pointer, okay. Don't lose it. Christine Kosh is awesome. It's so nice to work with her. Okay, here we are. Yeah. No, I'll just hold it. What a great presentation the previous one was, and a great lead-in to mine, so I'm just totally lucky. I'd really like to thank the BC Farm Writers Association, first off, for inviting me to speak, and Christy Davis. It's just a wonderful opportunity to get in front of a more national group of people who do such a dedicated job in bringing knowledge to farmers. And you know, there's such a need. If you ever have an opportunity to bring good knowledge about farming into the urban areas, and in BC, we really feel this. We're 98% urban, and we could use a lot more real farm information. Anyway, as the introduction said, I did my undergrad at University of Saskatchewan, and I was in class in my undergrad with Jeff Shano, Dr. Jeff Shano, talking about sulfur, and I just had this epiphany in this class, thinking, you know, the way of the future is going to be intensive agriculture production systems. And I have followed that ever since, right into the Fraser Valley here, and it's been really fun to work with the BC Ministry of Agriculture, their incredible programming to support agriculture. And so I would like to give you some insight today into why this might be important. And I think there's another side to this question. Are you serious? You know, because we all think, isn't local food production just a passing yippee phase? And food production should happen out there somewhere. So just next slide. So I'm going to try to cover a few questions. So why bother farming in smaller regions? There's bigger areas. As long as you're taking my picture, I'm really going to hide. You know, we know that there's really large areas on the continent, and the idea is you only farm where there's absolutely nothing else that you can do that's of any use. And then you think, okay, what about the Fraser Valley? Is the farming here really viable? And isn't replacement of farmland with urban development just going to happen anyway? But if farming does continue in the Fraser Valley, how is it likely to evolve? So those are the kind of questions that I thought about that might be in the back of your mind and trying to get at some of this. So why bother farming in smaller regions at all? And I think agriculture, really, if there is any other use of land, it could never be considered the highest and best use. However, if you take a look at some of the literature that's coming out now, and there was a series of articles in Science in 2010, Godfrey et al., if you want to read it, from Oxford University, that really went over our food security. And I think, as an agrologist, that's some of the best literature I've read on the issue of food security. There was a key article there about increasing the capacity of world food production to feed 9 billion people. And 1 billion more people currently who need more food. At the same time, we need to mitigate the impacts of climate change on agriculture, adjust to climate change. We're not going to have more land to feed people on. We need to manage in some areas with fairly scarce water resources and not compromise the Earth's biodiversity. Basically, what this amounts to is a perfect storm. Next. So where are you? Another nod. So food production capacity is one of the key problems. It's not the only key problem, but it's one of the problems affecting food security again. So the world food demand, is going to increase. And food demand is different than food production. Food demand is about what people want to eat. And so people are eating higher up the food chain. They're wanting to eat more meat as they get wealthier. And there's projected to be an increased food demand between 50 and 100%. I know that's a big range, but that's basically, some people say one number, some people say another. And again, farmland availability is an issue. And the issue of farmland is getting kind of critical. About 30 million hectares of the really, really good, really dependable farmland is forecast to be lost to urbanization by 2050 because our urban centers are growing. So we're all in the position of having to make difficult decisions, all of us, all over the world. In the past, when humanity would get struggling with food, we would always find new fisheries to exploit. There'd always be some fish somewhere or some part of the ocean that could be exploited further. There'd always be more land we could develop. And this is currently not the case anymore. Next slide. So land degradation, in addition to urbanization, land degradation is soaking up a lot of land. So 30 million hectares lost to urban development, but between 2,000 and 50,000 hectares of land lost annually because of issues like desertification. And the slide I have here is interesting. So this currently in California, you can click it one more time. This currently in California is a picture taken in 2009, and this is a dead almond orchard. This almond orchard will be cut down, or was cut down that year. And it's an example of where you have ongoing drought crises and poor water resources. And that is an example of land degradation. But what's of interest to that, if you're from British Columbia or anywhere in Canada, is that we rely on California for a lot of our food. Next slide. So large areas that are used for agriculture production only rely on rain for water. That's rain-fed agriculture. So I'm going to be giving you a few boxes here. One is rain-fed agriculture. The other is irrigated agriculture. And in irrigated agriculture, it's 17% of the land base of the agriculture in the world can be irrigated. It supplies 40% of our food. The rest of it comes from rain-fed, and this is a picture near Eston, Saskatchewan. And we know from reporting in Canada that this rain-fed area is becoming less reliable. The weather patterns are getting a bit weird. And grain production requires very steady weather patterns. Next slide. So I have a little picture here somewhere. And how does it work? What do I? Oh, there it is. There's a little gray button. No, I won't put it in anybody's eyes, I hope. So I like this slide. So if you're trying to get bigger picture stuff on where is water going with ongoing climate change, there was, of course, the report released just last week with the IPCC. I like the work done by Grace, and if you have the notes pages to what I'm writing, I've written it out for you. The Grace modeling is very, very interesting, and I can talk to you about it in more detail. But what this says is that this is about water. So if it gets bluer, it means losing water. If it gets redder, it means you're gaining water. And so the situation is that, and if it stays yellow, and you can't maybe see it here, but this is a bit blue in here, and yellow. If it stays yellow, it means you're kind of staying the same. So this is blue in through here, and then there's pockets that are redder, red through here, and then there's kind of like basically yellow in through here. What the GRACE modelers are starting to believe is that what we're seeing is a bit of a translocation of water from equatorial areas into like southern latitudes into northern latitudes. It's interesting for me when I look at this, and what's compelling about this slide for me is that this is our current food reliance area. This is where we rely on for a lot of our food. And Canada is getting redder. So if this is actually true, it means that Canada is increasing in its agriculture food production capacity, and the areas we currently rely on are decreasing. And I think that is a very compelling bit. If that science is true, which I think it is becoming true, I think we really have to think in Canada about our land use policies. So irrigation is the key. Forward, you know, and if we can have, it's good to have cropland, but you need water plus cropland. Irrigation is the key. If we water plus soil makes a huge difference, and climate. Again, forward. So as was pointed out, very often our most dependable farmland is located adjacent to growing cities. Our urban areas have often been developed where there's traditionally been the most reliable farmland. And by reliable, I mean farmland where you're not going to, where farmers can afford to put in high value crops because their input costs and infrastructure costs are going to be paid back over time. They're not going to plant high value crops where we are getting a lot of uncertainties with climate, with rainfall and that kind of thing. You can't really do it if you're going to get such extreme weather events that all your infrastructure is just going to be flattened every 5 years. You need reliable, dependent food lands to really make investments on. Next slide. Well, anyway, one...
You want to go back?
Forward. So did you, Did you have that one on when I was talking about rat? Okay, well, that's what I mean. And this is an overview. This is of Richmond. So this is what I mean about reliable, dependent foodlands in our urban areas. Another thing I'll point out here is the edge. But, yeah, anyway, there's a lot of interesting things here. But we'll go forward.
I'm halfway through my time, yeah.
Anyway, this could be so much just, you know, blah, 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 the climate change might not be happening, there could be no water relocation, everything could be as normal. Even if that was the case, with regards to agriculture in BC, next slide, you know, we'd still have this issue of public goods and services. The value that the public place on farmland is very high. We've done a couple of studies on this, actually, and it's really incredible that 95% of British Columbians really support having local farmland. They have this value about it. And part of it is because they want local food production, they want the green space, they see it as a way of preserving biodiversity, wildlife habitat, and nature. And the way that this is measured, so it's really an emotional value, it's really a spiritual value that people have. This is what they want. But they value it as highly as Stanley Park. So when the trees blew down in Stanley Park in that awful windstorm, people donated $10 million to replace what essentially was $1 million of trees. British Columbians actually value their farmland at the same rate. If you looked at the market value of the farm products produced, this was in Metro Vancouver, $5,750 an acre at the time the study was done. They said that the public value, the amount that they valued the land at per acre was 58,000, 10 times. And the value in perpetuity is 1 million, over a million. So basically that is how you would calculate what people emotionally and spiritually feel is their trust. Go forward. So let's just talk quickly about agriculture in the Fraser Valley, and this is the remainder of the talk. You know, like really, the Fraser Valley, it's just a blip on Canada's huge natural capital in agriculture. Let's keep going forward, just go right through. It isn't, you know, and like one of the press releases about it, or there's a bit of an article in the press that said this is just a lot of land that remains ugly, unkept, and unproductive. True story. Yeah, press is always good. Sorry, guys. Anyway, it is small. I'll grant you that. It's only about 130,000 hectares, and it only comprises about 0.2% of Canada's arable land. But it does produce 4.5% of Canada's farm gate receipts. And it produces $18,000 per hectare, where the Niagara Peninsula, which is the next other place in Canada that most closely resembles it, produces about $8,000 a hectare. So it is extremely interesting to look at this productivity. Just roll through. So it's the number one producer in Canada for high bush blueberries. Our production this year was 105 million pounds. It was down about 50, it should have been about 125 million pounds, but we had a terrible spring and a few other issues. And it's got the highest production of raspberries in Canada. Keep going forward. And it's number two in Canada in cranberries and also in greenhouse vegetable production and nursery production. And I could go on. Well, we won't go into the number threes. But it is, this is important. If the Fraser Valley wasn't there, I think Canada would feel it. You would actually see it in your grocery stores. But anyway, we can think, oh, okay. Maybe the rest of Canada has weather issues. You know, BC, okay, it's known for nice weather. So, but what about if we could just move this production somewhere else? Why does it have to be taking up space where we want to live? But if you look at this, you can see that the little red blip on the top is the area in BC that's capable of this production. And the rest of it, the blue area, that would be the Peace and everywhere else. The rest of the ALR in British Columbia just does not have that kind of capacity. Forward. So let's just talk about the Fraser Valley agriculture production. It's got a benign, it's got three things that make it quite exceptional. The climate, the soils, and the water. Three things together. There aren't that many production zones that have these three things in the abundance the Fraser Valley has. Please go forward. The climate in the Fraser Valley is very moderate, and you know, it makes such a difference. It's so incredible when you look at the importance of climate. Right on the delta, right on the coastline, that's where you grow tomatoes. You go a little further inland, and tomatoes don't grow as well. You're growing peppers. You go further inland towards Agassiz, you're growing flowers. So, and it's all about the fine differences in the climate. It makes a big difference. Go forward. The soils are really incredible here. The best soils, some of the best soils are in Agassiz, and I think some of you took a bike tour yesterday through Agassiz, and you were driving around some of the best soils, beautiful loam soils, deep soils, gorgeous, very, very fertile. And partly fertile because there's been so much manure put on them over the years. And then water. You know, most water used in agriculture in the Fraser Valley, most of it, not all of it, is from groundwater. Some of the water used in Delta and Surrey is surface water derived. But it's abundant, and it's everywhere, and in most places it's extremely clean, and farmers can irrigate using it. Way forward. Good. So the economics of agriculture are amazingly robust, and despite the small area, despite the small farms, and despite the land costs and everything else. And I just want to explain how it ticks. So we have two sectors that are supply managed, very stable business model, and that seems to be critically important for a small area that's under pressure. It's got a very stable monetary base. The other two, and you can go forward. The other two are berry production and any type of greenhouse production. Those are like four pillars, or say four legs on a table. And what happens with that is that the dairy, the poultry, they both have similar needs in terms of feed. The dairy supplies a lot of land base. The berries are also very, very lucrative here. Berries can outcompete on world markets. And the greenhouse vegetables the same. So you can actually you don't need to protect your markets. They are able to attain those markets. And the other thing, forward. And then you've got a lot of niche markets. So you see on the landscape a lot of berry and poultry, but actually if you turn the corner, you're going to see a lot of other varieties of things growing. And a lot of it is crops grown for specific ethnic groups, specific markets within Vancouver. And if farmers can target those markets, they can do very well. They can really get a premium for their product. The legislative environment and policy is very, very important in order to get this. So what you need to do, or what has made the Fraser Valley tick, is the fact that the land is protected. And what this has done is people have really invested in agriculture. That has been the result of having a protected land base. So the profits made from agriculture are reinvested. People are putting tremendous amount of capital into their farming, and then they're getting highest efficiency production. Go forward. And yeah, that's an example of that. So I think that there was some talk made about the conflicts, and I can answer questions on this. I actually receive calls on conflicts. I have a lot of experience in dealing with them. But we do what we've done in BC is we've used a very unique marriage to make this happen. And this is what I'm trying to point out here. It is, we've married planning principles with agriculture. And in most places, that's not what happens. But we've used planning principles such as bylaw tools. We've got a right to farm that can override bylaws. And we have other tools which are called farm bylaws, where we do edge planning, and where we could do edge planning, and this type of thing. And what it has allowed us to do is to intensify and use the land base very efficiently. So if you could just go forward into where you're at, that one. You can see the efficiency of the land use here. Now, if you used conflict resolution mechanisms like minimum distance separation, you scatter the agriculture. If you use planning mechanisms, you can tighten it, and the land can be used very, very efficiently. That's something that I could go into a lot of detail in. It can get a little dry in a presentation, but I'd be so happy to sit down and discuss it with you in detail if you are interested in that particular topic. So just go forward. Is that what you were looking at? Yeah, so this is a few slides about the fact that there is pressure. And I can't go into some of the details about this pressure, but there is pressure, two more clicks, on edges, and that I can't comment on today. Anyway, go forward. I had a call from head office. Oh, there we are. Okay. what this is about now, this is small lots and these are larger lots. So just go forward. Yeah, so we did. We've done land use inventories, and I think, are we right out of time?
Yeah, we're right out of time.
Okay.
All right,
so I'm just going to wrap it, and what we'll do is we'll just say that what this slide shows is that the smaller lots and subdivision, it does not engender farming. This is farming on small, on less than one hectare. This is farming on 52 to 64 hectare land. So the larger the parcel, the more likely it is to be farmed. And when you're thinking of agriculture may move from the U.S. into Canada, and we continue to subdivide all across Ontario, all across Saskatchewan, we have to think about, is that going to keep farming viable? So just go forward. So anyway, I just wanted to finish on the idea that even if there's an elsewhere area, even if we find another planet, and there's an area like Kazakhstan that can supply the whole world with food that is yet undiscovered, we still have this value of local agriculture, and we hold it deep in our hearts, and we value it very much as British Columbians. We love it, and we are really willing to pay for it, and we're really willing to defend it. So thank you very much for your attention.